Manhattan. No longer have a house upstate.
So you were in LA for, it seemed like a while there. When did you move back to New York?
I was bi-coastal, so
Okay.
I never actually left New York.
Yeah.
But
When did you give up, I guess, your LA house is
I
moved.
moved from LA to Hudson in 2012. Yeah, I had a house in LA from 2006 to 2012, and then a house in Hudson from 2012 to 2022, I guess. And I sold that, and now I have a one bedroom and two great big storage spaces, one for books and one for instruments.
I was listening to some, I guess I would say relatively recent interviews. It happens that the last time you did a number of interviews was right at the beginning of the pandemic, and it sounded like you rode at least the early days of it out in the city, which was surprising to me because at the time you had like property upstate.
Yeah, well, post Beatles ate the first floor, so it wasn't habitable.
I mean, again, I'm in Astoria myself, and this was kind of a pretty miserable. No, I don't think there was a good place to ride out a global pandemic, but being in a apartment in New York City was pretty miserable, I would say.
I have a friend who has a large sprawling estate near Philadelphia. I think he was fine.
Would you consider yourself a social person?
I force myself to be a social person.
Yeah.
But I and my mother and her brother, so my family is composed of three people, myself, my mother, and her brother, and all of us are moody loners who just haven't gone on a killing spree yet.
Yeah. Have you ever felt close?
To go on a killing spree?
Yeah.
No, none of us own guns.
So in terms of like efficiency, it would be too difficult to go on a killing spree with like a knife or something.
I mean, I guess you could go on a killing spree with battery acid, really.
Sure. Yeah. It strikes me, I don't know. I could totally be misreading it, but it seems like you are maybe a happier person or at least in a better place than you were maybe, 10, 15 years ago.
Frame of mind? I am in a different frame of mind. Since I got COVID, I have not finished a song, and my IQ seems to have been lowered, and the neurologist says that my temporal lobe is out of sync with the rest of my brain. Things like that. So I don't think of it as like a being happier or more content or anything. I'm just sort of, I guess I think of it as brain fog.
It's always struck me that highly intelligent people tend to be depressed. So maybe there's some positive outcome that can come out of that. I've had it four times myself, and I have felt very
Four
similarly.
time.
Four times, yeah.
Have children?
I don't. I travel. I mean, not that you don't, but I travel a bit for work, and every time I've gotten it, I've been at like a conference or something else, and doesn't get easier, it turns out. Last time I had it in January, and I was stuck in, of all places, a Las Vegas hotel room for a week, just like feeling
Well,
very like fear and
room
loathing,
service, right?
No room service. We were at the one hotel in Las Vegas without room service, just a
I've
really
never heard of that.
miserable, a Marriott Residence Inn, which are those are the ones that are basically like getting a hotel room in a college dorm. You've got a refrigerator, but no room service.
Let's see.
Yeah. But how, like, day
Could
to day to
order
day.
groceries on Amazon or something, I suppose.
That's right. It was like Uber eating for a week. But day to day, I mean, how does that How does that manifest itself? I mean, how is your life and how have your interactions with people changed in the since you contracted it back in 2020?
I suppose I actually probably don't want to focus entire interview sure. on my medical condition. I have become more aware of the benefits of hanging out with other people.
Mm.
It became phenomenally difficult to hang out with other people.
You realize the benefits because you weren't doing it as much as you used to.
Right. And I had to choose who I was hanging out with in ways that had much more significant effects than usual.
I ask partially because, you know, reading some interviews that you've done and talking about your early life with your family, it sounds like you had a lot of alone time and that you, to a certain extent, got really good at being alone.
When I read Huckleberry Finn, which has long whole second act about being essentially imprisoned, I was in Hawaii on a Buddhist commune, Zen commune, where we were forbidden to talk. And I was the only child there, which was often true of my childhood. So I literally couldn't talk to anyone for 23 hours a day during the brief periods when people could talk. They didn't particularly want to talk to me as I was an 8-year-old. I read these scenes of being cooped up. It's Jim in the book who is cooped up, and then as I recall, Huck is trying to get him out.
It's been a long time.
It's been half a century since I read Huck Finn. I should read it again. I totally identified with that. I was like, oh, this is weird. I'm reading about the exact situation I'm in. Not exact, but the directly analogous situation that I'm actually in while reading.
Yeah. How did you cope?
I didn't think of it as a situation in with. I didn't think of it as needing to be coped with.
In hindsight, though, when you look at it, I guess maybe how did you survive that? Did you have any survival mechanisms?
I wasn't suffering. I was perfectly okay with not talking.
That's changed, though, obviously. You know, it sounds like you've gotten to a point where you need people and you need some socialization.
Probably. I don't experience it that way. But my mother was in the pandemic a lot more alone than I was. She's in her 80s, so it was a lot more important, even more important for her to not get COVID from me in particular. She did eventually get COVID, but and she survived it pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that in those early days that it was a bit of a perfect storm, because another element I understand of your inability to really write at the time was that you have a very clear process, and it involves you actually like going out in the world, whether or not you're actually interacting with people directly. And obviously, like the rest of us, you weren't able to do that.
I was so much better off than my mother, though, that I guess I
sure.
itself is pretty fortunate.
Yeah, I just mean in terms of the impact that it had on your songwriting.
I don't want to overdo that because I do have hundreds of songs sitting around
sure. here,
and no one would ever know if I never wrote a song again in my life, because I could just use the ones I already have that I haven't found an album for yet. But also, this morning I had a bit of a realization. I listened to a song and I realized it's a song I really like. It's You Dropped a Bomb on Me.
Oh yeah, the Gap Band.
It's a really delightful song. But as a song, as opposed to a track, it's really hard to say that it's finished in any way. It's essentially formless. Basically, all the instruments are doing exactly the same thing over and over. It's what I call a loop song.
Mm.
Only the vocal really changes. And once in a while, there's the delightful sound effect. But how would one decide that the song on paper, pen and paper, how would you decide that it was finished? I think when I think of myself as not having finished a song in 4 years, it's probably really that I haven't finished a song by my standards. The only song that I've arguably finished was for Anthony Roth Costanza and Justin Vivian Bond's album of duets, and I finished it by writing on the sheet music, ad lib here. but some people would call that finishing the song. And definitely the Gap Band would call that finishing a song. It's like, this is where the ad lib goes. But for me, traditionally, I only really have one song in my entire career that has any ad-libbing at all, which is Love is Like Jazz, which is entirely ad-libbed, and part of the way it goes is that it can never be rehearsed. And that nothing about it can be agreed upon beforehand. So it is essentialist free jazz. It's like whatever instrument you're holding is the instrument you're playing on the song, and you have no idea what the song experience is going to be like before you start. The only form of it is that there is a lyric, and the lyric can be sung to any melody in any style for any length of time. It's I grew up loving experimental music. And this is the Cajun version of free jazz. It's maximally indeterminate. But how did I decide that it was finished? I don't know.
In a very real sense, it never really is finished, right? If it's a new sure. version every time.
Yeah, yeah. Down to the melody cannot be described beforehand.
Does that song exist on paper in any way?
It's on Six Man Love Songs. So it exists as a lyric, as part of the lyric sheet of Six Man Love.
Yeah. But not Cajun in the sense that it's, you know, like, that there's specific instructions with how to play it.
Yeah. When I wrote the lyric in some notebook somewhere, there is the lyric for Love is Like Jazz and the instructions that it can't be rehearsed. And is not expected to be repeated. And after recording it, I would have added that the record is not considered a definitive version in any way and shouldn't be a guide.
Are there any other songs that you'd point to in your catalog that you feel like fill a similar role that are experimental in that same way?
Well, yeah, having said that it's unique, it's not unique because there's also Experimental Music Love, which is also a lyric whose performance is indeterminate. And we did it a particular way on the record, and we do it pretty differently live. But as of the last 2 weeks, we actually have the technology to do it essentially the same way we did on the record, which is new and novel and fun for us. So we actually are making it sound basically just like the record, which is funny for us. An in-joke, I guess.
Is that ever, aside from that song, is that ever the goal to make, especially, you know, I mean, it's interesting.
This absolutely not. But we usually prefer not to sound too much like the record so that it doesn't sound like we're trying and failing to exactly reproduce the record.
Yeah.
I saw the band The Chameleons, the UK version of The Chameleons, at CBGB. Everyone sounds terrible, sounded terrible at CBGB.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Tom Tom Club at CBGB and they sounded terrible. And, you know, they played CBGB hundreds of times in the 70s. So they were recording a live album that never came out because, of course, they sounded terrible. I was very happy to be there, but, you know, you can't sound good at CBGB. Except that Chameleons sounded exactly like the record. It was really uncanny. It was just like they were playing to tape, but they really weren't. They just happened to know exactly what effects they used on the record and in what proportions. It was crazy how much they sounded like the record.
Are there instances you can think of where the songs, do you feel that the songs have gotten better over time? Do most of them get better over time?
Wait, let me finish that anecdote with what I realized was sounding exactly like the record is really boring if you already have the record. It's just like playing the record, only louder.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the point?
Yeah, I you know, it's so much like recording specifically is really just kind of capturing a moment in time. And
not for me.
No,
I have never recorded more than two musicians at the same time. And that only once, I think.
I just mean from the standpoint of, you know, versus continuing to like perform a song live and taking on different meetings. It's like a snapshot of of that period.
Okay. Well, from my perspective, it's often so long, many years, sometimes decades, between the writing of the song and the recording of the song. And sometimes the recording of the song takes months, not usually years, but sometimes. That it's not, it doesn't feel like a snapshot of a particular time at all. It's just a smear of the last 10 years or something. And once it's on the record, it starts aging as though it were captured in time. But the way I make records, snapshot would not be, it wouldn't occur to me to use the word snapshot. It's more like a palimpsest of different actions at different times.
I'm curious what you mean when you say it's aging as though it was captured in time.
Well, once there's an official version of something, I at least don't make more official versions of it. Although, I guess if I were a jazz artist, I would, in fact, do 100 versions of my favorite things that respond to each other. But the way I make records is I only make one. And then it gets copied and distributed, and that's the end of that. I don't revisit things. The only exception being Plant White Roses, which exists in at least two different versions with different singers and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there's a sense in which this tour is revisiting, in that it's going back to a specific album.
Yes. We noticed that there is a reference to the Clinton administration in the song Blue You. The lyric is, the president played the saxophone, sounded so alone, it was on the news. And that is a clear reference, if you were there at the time, to the Clinton administration, which was the current administration in 1999. And things sure have changed. and somehow noticing that made us really more vividly aware of specifically how things have changed. And love has changed, and definitely love songs have changed. In 1999, a lot of the genres on the record were ongoing. Some were not, but I mean, some are Scott's ballads and they're not ongoing. But some of the genres on the record have just died out.
Yeah.
And we're like, at the time, many of them had died out, but in the last 25 years, even more of them have died out. So things that were meant to sound contemporary at the time now sound like it's 1999. Which I wouldn't have expected, because I thought that I was being very conservative about dating myself. I always thought that if you use the latest technology, that it will quickly sound dated, because the next year, everyone knows that that's last year's technology. Whereas if you play a lute, no one's going to say that sounds like last year.
Lyrical references are another way of dating songs.
Ordinarily not, but in the case of Blue You, yes. Yeah, nothing on 69 Love Songs refers to computer dating. Excuse me. There are no three ways or throuples, and the expectation of monogamy is definitely not something that would occur if somebody did an album of 69 love songs now. So love itself has changed, and now the typical song on the radio, the archetypal song on the radio, is Wet Ass Pussy.
Mm-hmm. Has part of this experience of re-engaging with the songs in this way been this consideration of how you would go about it were you to start it in 2024?
Well, I can't imagine that I would start it in 2024.
Sure. But it's an interesting thought exercise to consider how, you know, the subject matter of the songs themselves would be different.
The category of love song seems itself to be no longer in public use.
Mm.
Like, that's not the way we would put it now. I think. I mean, you'd probably just say it's the song is romantic, or not sexy enough to be about fornicating.
Do you feel though that the fact that love songs aren't, you know, as you said, in use in the same way, that in and of itself would dissuade you from taking them on?
Not so much that, but that it might not have occurred to me in the first place. Like, it's not one of the categories that one works with anymore. Like punk funk or what did Linkin Park play? What was that genre called?
New metal.
Nu metal, yeah. There's no nu metal anymore. And it is no longer the new wave of British heavy metal. You wouldn't That category is not a current category. Nor can you make grunge music now. It
Yeah.
wouldn't be called that. It's
It
a
would be post-grunge.
historical category.
It strikes me that constraints are a really important part of the songwriting process for you, in terms of at least giving yourself direction.
Yeah. I do word games in the morning. I do crosswords and other Wordle and such. And like Stephen Sondheim, I think of songwriting as a whole lot like doing a word puzzle. You have to find a certain number of rhymes. You have to fit what you are trying to say into a certain number of syllables without hopefully making it really obvious that you're filling syllables as much as you are saying something. The great unacknowledged innovation of Bob Dylan is that he called attention to the process by intentionally making it silly. The pumps don't work because the vandals took the handles.
Handle, yeah.
Actually happened. I don't know if you know this.
I don't know the story behind that now.
In the middle of Woodstock, there used to be a pump for the public well, and it literally happened when he was in Woodstock, in Big Pink, I guess, or maybe at Albert Grossman's house. He heard that you couldn't use the pump because someone had taken the handle. And he turned it into the immortal line, "The pump don't work because the vandals took the handles." Which just sounds like it's a bit of nonsense that rhymes vandals and handles randomly, and it's during the fade out of the song, so it sounds completely tossed off, and it doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the song. In fact, I can't remember which song it's from.
Is it Subterranean Homesick Blues?
One of those, I'm not sure anything else in Subterranean Homesick Blues has anything about relating to other parts of the song. Yeah,
Yeah,
either.
it's free. It's a pretty free
I like it.
association song.
Yeah, it's abstract expressionism.
Yeah. What's your sense of why that silliness, or why Dylan's sense of humor? Like, he's somebody, you know, there are more words written on Bob Dylan than, you know, just about any other artist short of the Beatles. Why is that so relatively unremarked upon or underappreciated?
A lot of people don't have a sense of humor at all. And only somewhat smaller group don't appreciate humor in art. Some people hate humor combined with sex. Some people hate humor combined with art. Some people hate humor combined with food. they maybe think these things are too holy to be contaminated with humor or irony or play. I find those worldviews really bleak, and I'm happy to say that I find humor almost universally appropriate. You probably want to avoid humor while testifying in court. But other than that, I think even at a funeral, humor is welcome.
Yeah, especially at a funeral.
Sure.
Yeah.
So signs of humor are not welcome at a funeral.
Sure.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's called gallows humor for a reason.
Yeah.
I was talking to my therapist about this last night, and I was mentioning that I feel like, for me, humor has been as an introvert, as somebody who has difficulty relating to people one-on-one in person, that it's like a shortcut that I found for interacting with people and interacting with the world. What's that?
It's like a shortcut. It's like punching them.
Yeah. It catches them off guard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're in a different conversation.
Yeah. But the reason why I brought it up is because I was worried that from a professional standpoint that in certain situations that people might not take me as seriously if I was quick to a joke with things, or would feel that I was making full of light of things, or that I wasn't taking things seriously because I had a humorous take on them.
It's almost always bad to be sarcastic within 10 seconds of meeting someone. Even at someone else's expense. But after that, I think full speed ahead.
Do you think that there is an extent to which, not that this is something that bothers you, but is there an extent to which that people maybe don't take art or music as seriously if it has humor in it?
I think it's more that people are puzzled by humor.
Mm.
The whole category of novelty songs used to be, maybe that's another historical category, there used to be compilations, lots of compilations of novelty songs. Dr. Demento was an entire genre for a while. And that has gone away. And we no longer call anything a novelty song, no matter what it is. If you write a song about cooking naked with Nancy Reagan, it's not a novelty song anymore. It's just not called that. And I think a lot of people would not think of it as an attempt at humor, but just think of it as artistic license or something.
Or social commentary.
Right. I guess it depends on who did it, too. There are racist and misogynist inflections of who is considered to be sophisticated enough to be funny. And so some people, no matter how incredibly silly Lil Nas X is, some people just don't realize he's joking. They just don't get it. Don't see it as humor. They don't see it as intelligent. He's just gay and black, and they think that that's like the entire description of his brain, rather than that he's hysterically funny.
I think he also has the obstacle of there are certain subjects with certain people that if you joke about them, that they will never find funny. And religion Satanism is one of those things with large swaths of people, they will automatically think that
everyone else finds it funny. Like,
yeah,
because it's a sacred cow for silly people. The rest of us joke about Satanism all the time. Again, we stopped in the 80s for a while, but now it's back. And what is sillier than the idea that a satanic cabal in a pizzeria is eating babies as a part of the Democratic Party regime? It wouldn't be so silly if it were the Republicans. It's just the Democrats are so banal that it's badly silly.
I think you might have backed into another point there too, which is that again, it's a hacky thing to say, but probably for a reason that there's a certain threshold that you cross where satire is no longer satirical, you know, where that's a reality that people are living with, so they don't find much humor in it.
It's very difficult to satirize Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you exaggerate her?
It strikes me, you know, knowing what I do know, what little I do know about your background and your early life with your mother, you know, that Buddhism, that ritual, that a lot of her explorations, I guess, of what we would call spirituality were really big, played a really big role in your life and where you grew up. But were you, even at a young age, were you able to find humor in some of those things in religion?
So my mother was raised Catholic, and her approach to Tibetan Buddhism has been very obviously colored by her background in Catholicism. She loves the pomp and ritual and gold leafing and brightly colored costumes. For me, having not been raised Catholic, I find that all absolutely silly, absurd, preposterous, dumb, pointless, hugely wasteful. And at this point, I just won't be around it. But I no longer have to be around it, because now that I have COPD, no one expects me to go into a room with incense burning, because I can't stand up for very long in a room with incense burning. Fine with me. I don't want to be in a room with incense burning, Catholic or Tibetan Buddhist or other. I just... intentionally polluting the air to give people less oxygen in order to give them a religious experience. For me, that's totally transparent. They're making you dumb to make you religious. And that's how it works. My mother doesn't understand this and never will. And she doesn't think it's silly at all, which... she's missing that gene that allows her to use humor as an analytical tool, as it is, to critique her own so-called spirituality.
You are a splendid butterfly. It is your wings that make you beautiful. And I could make you fly away.